without any further ado, my buddy Mike.
Hey, Mike.
Yeah, Mike Lorenz, alcoholic. Rite Aid, September 7th, 1985, member of the Diggs Group, Alcoholics Anonymous. And boy, I'll tell you what, I was thinking here, I wrote that original inventory around some pressured talking. This has got more pressure than talking. I mean, when you've got to meet Katie's standards and do it Katie's way, that's... and you start off as one of her heroes, there's not much upside left, you know. The smart guy folds and goes home right then. But I've never been a smart guy, so we'll keep at it. One of the things that I have in my experiences is I had this old idea that this business of inventory was like, almost like an AA hazing ritual. It's what you had to do to be one of the guys or one of the gals. And it was just a big hassle, you know, a lot of homework and all that kind of stuff. And I thank God the people that saved my life took me to a different understanding where it's really about bringing, it's all about, I talk about this incident or that resentment or one thing or another, but it's all about bringing me into a closer relationship with God. And Katie talked about this business of God, you take it. Well, you know, God turns out isn't like a spiritual recycling bin in the same, you know, sense. I don't get just to dump my garbage in there. The relationship I have with a higher power is one I describe as one of informed consent. In other words, just telling God to take it, yes. When I was on the bathroom floor and made that first surrender and just said help, yeah, that prayer was answered. But as I move along, God wants me, in my experience, to know what it is and why I'm turning things over. And so I got... That's why I'm doing part of this self-examination to find out exactly what it is I'm turning over. And for me, it's very much it's a spiritual consent, very much like a surgical consent. You know, they came up to me. I'm laying on a gurney outside in the OR some years ago, and they said, "Okay, Mr. Lorenz, we think you probably got cancer based on a biopsy. We're going to go in. We're going to open you up. We're going to look at this. We're going to look at that. According to what we find, we may do this, we may do that. Do you consent?" They did not tell me that I could perform my surgery or consult on it. I just got to, they told me what the facts were as they knew them, then I got to make an informed consent to have that stuff. And that's what where I'm getting to with the inventory. Katie wants me to talk about fear, but to make another point perhaps, I haven't found anything that I've done that has caused harm and caused pain and everything else that wasn't driven in some ways by fear. The way I hurt you is just merely part of my coping skills, if you will. I mean, I know there are sociopaths out there, but I've lived basically a life of good intentions. I never, you know, do you want to break your mother's heart? Do you want to do this? Do you want to? Oh, of course not. Do you want to terrify children? Most people wouldn't say yes. You know, not even most alcoholics. But we do, you know. And why do we do that? Well, in my case, that's where I get to see that I'm driven there by the fear. The first place I really saw it in this little piece of inventory was where I really got a first step that I could keep. And this was a piece of conduct inventory. This was the one that had, year after year, when I, you know, any time this woman would come across my mind, it was just kind of like a shadow came across the sun. I had that sinking feeling. She was my college sweetheart, the gal I wanted to marry. I loved her. Her dad and I played and hunted together and fished together, and we loved each other and spent time together and all this kind of stuff. I mean, her brothers and sisters, they were not, when I was out on the West Coast in the service, her brothers came up to Fort Ord, California to visit me. I mean, they were not just treating me like the regular boyfriend. This was a family I wanted to be part of for the rest of my life. And here's what I did. So, Ellen, whereas I was selfish, I wanted to enjoy sex with her regardless of the consequences. I was dishonest, told her not to worry that I'd always be there for her no matter what. Dishonestly refused to consider my ability and willingness to keep that promise. I was inconsiderate. I gave scant consideration to the consequences of my behavior to her, her family, her faith, her reputation, and her career. I aroused jealousy. I told her if she didn't have sex with me, that I'd get it elsewhere. Paid undue attention to other women in her presence and told her how attractive I found them. Aroused suspicion. Often spent time alone with other women. She found me at Holly's apartment. Bitterness. When she became pregnant, I told her I doubted that it was my child. I told her mother that I was too young to get married and didn't want to marry her anyway. And when she was in California having our baby, I made drunken calls to her anger. I banned her, our child, and because I was back in the Midwest and she was off in California, I told everybody she deserted me. Who did I harm? The baby, Ellen, her family, my friends, our friends, my family. What should I have done instead? And side note, but this is the vital part of this, really. This is, again, part of that informed consent, because this is where I start to get a vision. If God, the question here is, if God would change me from this guy, from what I put on the paper and just admitted as objectionable, see, I can stand to break your heart. What really changes me is when my heart, I break my own heart. I can't stand myself. I can't stand looking at this. And I can't stay sober if I know I'm going to have to be that guy the rest of my life. Am I going to do this to somebody else again? You know. So now I get a vision, this vision here. And if God would be willing to change me, what would I want that to look like? It's changed over the years, but the first it was this. I should have treated sex as the sacred gift that it is. I shouldn't have engaged in behavior I wasn't willing to be responsible. I should have honestly faced the consequences of my actions. I should have been honest with myself and others. My harms were all rooted in dishonesty, particularly about how afraid I was. Self-reliance will always produce fear and pain. That was a spiritual awakening, folks. Mike, with his best intentions, playing his best game with somebody he loves deeply, the best I'm going to end up with is fear and pain out of that. Now, on that basis, if I really believe what I wrote there, I absolutely don't have a choice but to seek some kind of a role, not just a belief, but a real working relationship with power greater than myself. And that starts the ball rolling here. Fear inventory. We get there, and Charlie may relate to this one here. The very first thing I was asked to do in Alcoholics Anonymous outside of my own local area was Don had me set up to do a retreat with the Santa Barbara crew out in California. And, I mean, you know, so I'm getting nervous before this thing's going on. I mean, you know, I'm maybe 11 years sober, and I'm going out to do this retreat at the mission in Santa Barbara, and I've, you know, talk all weekend and everything else in front of all these people that are AA slick and everything. And the fear is building, the fear is building, and the fear is building. And then all of a sudden, I realized it wasn't so much fear about going there. I was afraid to get on that airplane and fly out there. And one of the things that they give me, inventory didn't have to be, it turns out, this big, long, drawn-out exercise. A post-it note works. You know. And this little piece I'd gotten from a guy by the name of Mickey Musset up in Denver that was kind of part of my extended family. And I wrote down, quickly, I'm afraid of flying because I'm out of control. I'm going to have to wait in terror to die for the plane to hit the ground. I believe I deserve a horrible death, you know, for stuff like this and everything else. I've still got a God that's out there armed and dangerous and waiting to get me. I deserve to be punished for my wrongs. And, found one of those old ideas. And every time I can find an old idea, my life gets better, as it turns out. And the old idea here was somehow my fear is going to protect me. Now, I sit around meetings all the time. I hear people talking about bad fear and good fear. Folks, I don't think there is such a thing as good fear. What we maybe believe is, quote, good fear is simply awareness. You know, before that guy operated on me back in 2003, I wouldn't have wanted, you know, one of my sponsees to come in and hold a shotgun hit to his head and scare the hell out of him and tell him if he didn't do a great job on Mike, he was going to scatter his brains all over the OR, all that kind of stuff. I don't think that would have improved his performance, you know. What I wanted him that was sober, wide awake, and aware. Show awareness. That's what I'm looking for. Clarity of thought here. Not good fear. And so the funny thing at that time, I went ahead and did that, and there's an interesting postscript to that story. It turned out we can't see where these threads go. All of a sudden, for the first time, really, it brought me into a place where I could identify really with Bill. And I'll tell you how that happened. I mean, you know Bill's story. Yeah, he's a this, he's a that, and the goose hung high, and he's got a great coat of tan and all this kind of stuff. Bill talks about his experience at Winchester Cathedral on his way to World War I. You know, and he talks about needing and wanting God, and God came. You know, and then it was got his that relationship with God that had sustained him went away in worldly clamors and all that and so forth. And I got, oh, shit, you know. Have I always, when I first stepped that with me, he says, Mike, you always been afraid of flying? Says, no. He says, used to fly a great deal. He says, well, tell me about that. And I said, well, it was fun. I got on plane every chance I got. I flew a lot in Vietnam. I wasn't a pilot, but I was, my job kept me on helicopters a lot. As a matter of fact, I was on 5 different helicopters that went down and crashed for various reasons. 3 of them were shot down, 2 of them went down for mechanical failure. And every one, as Mickey talked to me about this, I realized I just hopped back on the next one without a thought. You know, it wasn't a big deal. And he says, okay, so when did you become afraid of flying? When he asked the question, I knew instantly. I became afraid of flying when I left Vietnam. When the combat was all over, and I was getting on this big fat, I can still remember the tail number on the airplane, United Airlines flight U2B4 out of Thompson Airport there in Saigon, and that plane's in the desert somewhere, parked. It's still got my arm prints of the armrest. I was like that all the way home. And I knew why. Because, see, when I went there, I knew no matter how good I was at my game, I led an infantry platoon most of the time. And I knew, I had a realization that no matter how good I was at that, no matter what my skill level was, that I couldn't ensure my own survival. I couldn't make it on my own. And so I needed and wanted God. Done some praying. And when it was all over, I thought it was all over and I was coming home. What I'd in effect done is I'd said, thanks God, I'll take it from here. And the minute I did that, the fear had appeared. Now, God never seems to do these things to help just one person. So 2 years later, I'm up near where you were. I was at the fall retreat up at Eugene at Sky Camp. And on Friday night there, for some reason on the opening session, I start talking about this fear of flying stuff. And I've got no idea why I'm doing that. And so we finish the session, take a break. And the guy that's recording this, I mean, I can see him over there. He's got his headset on and he's crying. And, oh, God, well, I don't think I'm that bad. But, you know, see, it's still all about me. And we come back after the break. And just before the break, this taper comes over to me. And he says, Mike, I've got three sons. The third oldest one lives in Atlanta, and he's dying of AIDS, and I haven't gone to see him because I'm afraid of flying. And I just called my wife and told her to make some reservations that we were going to go see our boy. When we clean up our messes, when we deal with our things, when we get into relationship, the benefits echo out from us. And God did that in such a nice way that I couldn't figure out that it was anything of my doing. You know, I was simply, as St. Francis says, we get to be a channel. Now, what Katie was talking about later on, apparently I got quite a relationship with this fear business here. I was back in 2000... I've been asked to substitute for my friend and teacher, Don Pritz. They were throwing this big deal in Palm Springs, California, and it was supposed to be like black tie for 2,000 people and fancy dinner and all this kind of stuff, and there was some kind of conflict, so Don convinced them for some reason that I should go and represent the family. So the Tuesday before I'm supposed to fly out to Palm Springs, I go to my local speaker meeting, and a guy I really like, Keith, is giving his pitch there. And I can't believe it. He sucks. I mean, I've known this guy for years, and, you know, I love him. We lunch together every couple weeks. Keith sucks. I can't, what's wrong here? And I managed to not say anything to him right after the meeting. I was, you know, going to give him some helpful suggestions how he might clean up his act. And as it was, I just thanked him and left. And, you know, I'm driving home, and this Keith sucking is just, you know, running around and around in my head. And all of a sudden, it gets him, wait a minute. This isn't about Keith. This is about you. You're scared about how this thing in Palm Springs is going to go. So now I got better training, so instantly get home, sit down, and here's what Katie heard here. This is a little inventory I titled Palm Springs Trauma. And it's, as you know, it's not in the book, but, you know, we kind of have a family tradition of doing a little short one-sentence prayer with pieces of inventory. So in this case, the prayer was, Dear Father, please give me the power to do your will and the strength and wisdom to do so with compassion. First fear is, I'm going to give a boring talk in Palm Springs. Well, why do I have it? Well, I'm full of pride, ego, and self-centeredness. I want to impress people rather than truly be of help and service. I want to show them how good I am rather than how great God and AA are. What's the better way? To trust God. I must turn to God and give the talk that He wants me to give. Next year, I'm going to go blank and forget everything I know. Well, I've got this because I not only want to manage my life, I'm trusting God. I'm not trusting God, obviously. The answer, trust God. Let Him clear my mind of the clutter of self-serving thinking so I can speak his truth. You know, as one of the results of this is I do the most unnatural act for me. I always have a plan. I had a plan in my head before Chisholm Trail. And what I do in the moments before I go talk is I get quiet with God and I hit the button to reformat the hard drive here. Say, God, okay, I had a plan, but we're going to just tear it up and your plan. It's not God. Don always told me, Mike, it's not God doing for you, it's God doing through you. Are you willing to be a channel? You know, are you willing to trust that? Well, the next fear after that is I'm going to be an embarrassment to the people who recommended me. Don, the big guy. You know, well, I've got this. I not only want to manage my life, I want to manage the feelings of others. And I'm not doing this for their benefit. I'm doing it for my comfort, my emotional comfort. Answer, trust God. Remember why I'm doing this, to be of service. Next fear. I don't really belong with this in crowd. I'm not who and what they think I am. As if they thought at all, you know. I mean, how much time do you spend really thinking about, you know. So I've got this fear because I'm reading minds. Once again, I'm more concerned with being what I fancy others think I should be rather than what God wants me to be. Answer, trust God. The truth is I've always received an abundance of love. For the St. Francis prayer, it's for me to seek to love rather than to be love. See, of course I've got fear because I want to stand up there and I want to suck love out of you. Not a people pleaser, I'm an approval sucker. You know, it's just people pleasing just sounds so much better. You know, and you'd think after this, you know, if they call up and cancel, I'd be relieved by, you know, to get out of this. But the next fear is, I'm afraid they're never going to ask me to do it again. Well, I've got this fear because I want to play God. I want to decide how I'm going to serve God. And my little, dirty little secrets, I'd be willing to take the place of somebody like Charlie or Katie who could more effectively carry the message just to serve my own selfish ends. Just to feed my ego. Answer, trust God. Perhaps I can serve God even as a fool. You know, I can be a splendid bad example at times. In any case, it's for God to decide how I shall serve him. I only get to decide if I will be of service, not how I will be of service. It's the if is the question I have to answer. And then finally, the last one is people will praise me out of kindness and pity. And I've got this fear because I'm acting from self-interest rather than out of a sincere desire to serve God and others. And another awakening. Who the hell am I to judge the kindness of others and reject it? I mean, just who the hell do I think I am? Bang. One of the things, you see, I was promised to me, and it's my experience, spiritual awakenings never feel good when they happen. I don't, well, oh, that's wonderful. I just, oh, that's what I was looking for. No, it's, you know. The answer is, trust God, I will always suffer when I turn to sources other than God for my sense of worth and well-being. And by this time, because of some work I've been doing with Don and others, they've taken me to the place where we flip the script, if you will. And this inventory is good insight as far as it goes. Very effective for me at the time. But then I get to turn it over and look at it on the other side of the page. Because remember, the real thing here is to bring me into a closer relationship with God. So if I'm going to look at, I look back at this list of fears and say, you know, here are all these fears, four or five fears I just went through. If these fears were going to be valid, what would I have to believe about God? What would God have to be in order for these fears to be rational on my part? because those fears are really a manifestation of a defect in my vision of that higher power and in how that relationship is. So this is what I'm really trying to find out. Not that I'm scared of talking someplace. Well, obviously, I believe God's just waiting to get me. You know, it's still that same thing out there. You know, what he wants, he's going to wait till I get my neck really stuck out there, and then I'm going to smack it. God doesn't really give a damn whether I'm happy or not. He just wants me to be a good boy, work hard, do this stuff, you know, go on 12-step calls, everything. But God doesn't really, at the bottom line, care about my happiness. And then finally, God's going to make a fool out of me, part of that deal. And then they ask me to ask the next set of questions. Yours would be different, because your relationship will be different. But, okay, that's what I have to believe to make these fears valid. Now, I get to ask myself the next question, is that what I really believe? Is that the God I really have in my life? So I get to come back and God doesn't think comparatively. God loved me just as much when I'm standing in a liquor store writing a bad check to buy a bottle of whiskey to go seduce the neighbor's wife as he does when I'm going to the treatment center with Charlie to try to help a newcomer. No, I get a different result according to which one of those things I'm doing. But that's not God punishing me. That's not anything else. If I go, you know, jump off the roof here and land on the pool apron, that is not God punishing me. That's gravity, you know. And so there are merely consequences attached to this whole thing. And if you think about it, if I could change whether God loved me or not by the way I acted, which one of us would be God? I could just move God around according to how I act. See, my ego will do anything to keep a seat at the table. My ego would prefer no God at all, but okay, if we got to have a God, let's at least get one that's crooked enough that you think you can maneuver him and make him jump through some hoops by being good or bad or whatever. This is just for me. You'll have a different. God won't make a fool out of me, but I can and will make a fool out of myself by trying to be what I'm not. Then God wants my happiness more than I do myself. We talked about that at Chisholm, you know. Oh, wait a minute. I'm in a relationship with a God that more than anything else wants my happiness. Not pleasure, happiness. And finally, God knows what will make me happy more than I do myself. And, you know, when we write all these inventories and everything else, essentially what I'm looking at is the record of Mike trying to create happiness for Mike. Every piece of that stuff I do, I'm trying to make myself happy and maybe incidentally you, you know, and what do? This is where I end up with. And so the reason here, yes, I get some insight here, but the insight is not stuff that I'm going to use to fix Mike. Oh, okay, I see. Now that was wrong there, so we'll do it this way. It's good to have, it's not bad to have that insight, but if I had the power to change myself, I would have changed myself. I wouldn't be here doing this right now. What I see is no matter what my good intentions, no matter how I love you, no matter whether I've always wanted to be a good guy. I always wanted to be somebody's hero. I always wanted my family to be proud of me. Those are the things I have wanted truly in my heart. And this crap is the way it looks like. I tornado through a lot of people's lives. I hurt kids. I hurt other people. I'm dishonest. And I'm not doing that. Mom, you know, one more check. You know, help me out one more time. It'll be okay. You know, I couldn't look her in the eye and try and pretend anymore that if she wrote one more check, her kid was going to get better. And so eventually, I built the case here that I absolutely have, for me, no rational choice but really seek that relationship with God. As a matter of fact, I come to the point where the only conclusion I draw is that anything at all God has in mind for me seems to be better than anything at all I've ever had in mind for myself. One of the big sources of my old ideas was always, if I ever actually abandoned myself to God, that it would, that I'd be, celibate in a 12-step house, washing dishes and asking new people if they wanted to be saved or something. I mean, I don't know what it would, It wasn't a glorious, it wasn't Katie Parker's living room in Austin, I'll tell you that. Old ideas. And an old idea is simply a limiting belief. And I had a friend that illustrates it so beautifully. He talks about, in reminding me of something I knew was true, he said, "Mike, you know how they train baby elephants? So they take baby elephants when they're little bitty elephants, and they put a heavy chain around their leg, and they pound a big long steel stake in the ground, and when that little elephant tries to move, that chain holds him right in place, and he's not going anywhere." And if you've been to the circus, and especially out back where they keep the elephants waiting before they go on, you'll see the elephants are out there. And now they're 8 or 10 feet tall, huge beasts, and there's a little piece of clothesline-sized rope around their ankle with a little wooden peg in the ground, and they're not going anywhere. And it's not that rope holding them in place. It's an old idea. So how many of those things do I have here? One of the things I just used to love about my friend Clinton, his wife, their idea for a weekend is, "Honey, let's find an old idea and get rid of it. It's the most fun thing we can do on a weekend. It'll improve our lives. It'll last. It won't show up on the Amex bill." So there it is. I guess I'll share one more piece of fear stuff quickly here, but I thought I had one maybe. Oh, yes. For 16 years, I had a partner in my business, Dave, and actually, the truth is, I was more a partner in Dave's business. I didn't see it that way at times. Yeah. He would occasionally have to walk me out and point to the door of our office that his name was above mine on the door. Anyway, "Dear Father, please take away my fear and direct my attention to your solution. This is office drama. Dave is going to demand a change in our office sharing arrangement. Why do I have this fear? Well, I've let my relationship with Dave just drift along. I haven't been willing to force a definition of the relationship because I feared more responsibility, either in terms of production targets or cash contributions. The vagueness seemed to suit my purpose." Anybody ever have a relationship where kind of keeping things fuzzy seemed to be the best deal there, Yeah. "What's the better? Trust God and humbly seek His help. I need to honestly look at Dave's side of things and remember he has fears too. I need to be willing to be specific as to duties and responsibilities. I'm going to get harmed by an acrimonious breakup. I've got this fear because I've seen some of Dave's behavior toward a previous partner. He did petty things like not forwarding mails or phone calls and so forth with clients. What's the better way? Trust God and humbly seek His help. I must strive to treat Dave fairly the way I want to be treated. I'm afraid of possible financial disputes arising out of years of unreconciled expenses. Well, got this one because my willingness for an accounting varied with whether I believed I was ahead or behind. Imagine that. Again, vagueness seemed to suit my purpose. My income will be harmed. It appears that no matter what the resolution may be, that my expenses will increase and I will have to pay Dave, buy equipment of my own, or partner with somebody else and absorb whatever cost that entails. Trust God and humbly seek His help. My income doesn't need to be harmed as long as I'm willing to become more productive. That's what I really don't want to see. Yeah. We go next fear. Now we're getting closer to the truth here. I will be forced to change the way I do business. While I serve my clients well, I do it on my terms and in my time. I virtually spend all my time on the care and feeding of current clients and don't care very much for prospecting. Trust God and humbly seek His help. I must be willing to embrace change in order to outgrow fear. Spiritual awakening, you know. If I want to outgrow fear, I'm going to have to embrace change. Now we're getting down to the real deal. I don't know how to change. I don't know how to change. I can't change myself. I've never been in a business that required me to be successful at prospecting. I've never had any kind of mentor in this area, and Dave is as lost as I am and can't teach me anything here either. Trust God and humbly seek His help. I must acknowledge my shortcomings and be willing to ask for and accept help. I need to get a business sponsor. Oh, okay. And then, of course, the real deal at the end, I'm going to fail and be humiliated. Got this, because I'm not trusting God. I'm trying to manage a relationship with another alcoholic. Dave's in the program. We got within a week at the same time. Both of us suffer from the disease of some extreme self-centeredness, and trying to manage this relationship is insane. I must turn to God. I trust God and humbly seek His help. God loves me and wants my happiness even more than I do myself. He allows me to fail so I can learn, not as a punishment. I must focus on God's agenda and not mine. That all worked out quite well. Time after time, I come back to this, and it's the names and the faces change, and so on and so forth. But the answers don't seem to change. The answer seems to be getting me back to, I lost my mind for a while and thought I wasn't powerless about this. I'm like an ant that's riding a log down a river. And the river goes around the bend, and because I was waving my arms, I thought I steered it, I've got this illusion because the flow of life has taken me someplace pleasant for a while, but somehow I've created all of this. And that feels good for a minute. It's kind of like wetting your pants, it's kind of nice and warm for a second, and then you realize if I've created it, I've got to sustain it, and We're running out of warm fast here, folks. And then the fear tsunami hits me. So did that cover something about what I'm
doing? Well, what I'm going to do is open it up for some questions or anything that you have. And I have one. Would you expound a little bit on what pleasure looks like as opposed to happiness?
Sure. In my lexicon, the difference is happiness is fulfilling and sustaining, and there isn't a penalty to be paid for it. There's no downside to happiness. Pleasure is sucking up a couple of pints of Haagen-Dazs or something like that, and I feel real good, and I really enjoyed it at the time, but, then I got the sugar crash on the other side of it, Great deal of pleasure in dating the married gal in the program, and you know, playing cards with her gun-toting husband on the weekends. I mean, you know, there's a lot of rush and excitement and everything else in that whole deal there. But definitely, you know, severe downside on that. That for you.
I'm the asker.
Well, what's the question? Is old idea.
Found more on old ideas.
Good question. Huh?
We're good tag team. I'm sure y'all pick up on our conversation.
Well, what specifically about old ideas would Charlie like to know?
Well,
you know, when you're talking about hanging on to old ideas, or driven by anything, is it my old ideas that are driving me? How do you look for old ideas, and how do you identify them?
Okay. Well, as we see, in the course of the inventory, every now and then, you know, the junk just falls out of it's like stuff falling out of a pickpocket's purse or pocket or something along the way. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know, I'm walking out of the store with that. I all of a sudden see this, and it's a principle I've frequently been operating on. You know, people aren't kind. They just pretend to be. They're really all out for themselves, and you can't trust them. For example, anything to do with. Like all women do this, and you know, and then attach whatever negative. You know, all guys do that. You know, whatever that kind of stuff are. You know, kind of you can see the tripwires after a while. That's probably attached to an old idea, and again, it goes. It's a limiting belief. Believing this limits my opportunity for happiness and freedom.
That's good.
And limits my relationship with higher power.
Well, and one of the things too is that I didn't realize that old ideas, they sound pretty good.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, I always thought old ideas were bad ideas. I don't know why I associated the word old with bad, but that's an old idea that I associated with bad. And what I realized is old ideas are like, you know, parents show up for their kids. And so you're driven to show up at every event when in fact you don't even want to be there and you don't really show up for every event. Why are you doing it? Because you're driven by this old idea and it's just really the best thing. And that's where you begin to realize when through the inventory process, right, it's in that third column where those old ideas really present themselves based on my self-esteem, my pride, my ambition, what I think, my personal relationships.
Yeah.
Which is that expanded third column.
Katie talks very much because until I see it, it's kind of like waving a black light around. All of a sudden, you see something pops out, or looking at a hologram, maybe even better one. You know, you don't see what's in the picture until all of a sudden. Well, how did I not see that horse there right in the middle of it? You know. So, oh, well, of course it's there. And then after that, you'll see it every time. But the first time, sometimes you can stare at it and stare at it and stare at it and not see it. That's what a sponsor is there to help point me toward that hologram, what's there in that hologram. And so, yeah, and it frequently sounds like wisdom. It was when I was looking at relationship stuff, it was embarrassing, looking back as an adult, how many ideas about relationships I got from bad old music, you know, lyrics.
Say it again.
How many ideas about relationships I got from bad old music? I mean, I remember one from, I was not that big back then, from some kind of hit parade show, you know, I will never love you, the cost of love is too dear. But though I'll never love you, I'll stay with you 1 year. Now, if you think that's it, I mean, 50 years later, I remember that. Now, you think that wasn't ingrained? Mm-hmm. Now, take that as, and that's what the big kids are singing and playing.
Yeah.
you know. So it must be true. These big kids that are going to high school and going to dance and driving cars, that's what they're singing and playing and doing. And I put that into place in my life, and I walk on, and I never even question it. And that's just one example. There are countless other examples of stuff that we find in there.
So I think that ties in the third step where it says, driven by 100 forms of fear, shelved old ideas that are driving me.
That's one of the primary ways those things manifest, yes.
And I remember when my sponsor...
Look at it. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old... And what was the result? Nil. Nothing. I mean, they're telling me right there that old ideas in and of themselves are enough to guarantee nothing happening.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's pretty serious to me.
Well, and that was the line that my sponsor quoted to me when we were talking one time on the phone. She said, old ideas, and how it works... And I said, what are my old ideas? And I mean, that was only about 4 years ago. It was like, I'm so delusional, I don't even know what an old idea is. I mean, when she said we have to let go of our old ideas, and I thought, what is an old idea? Well, then it's like the hologram. When I started looking, wow, I couldn't believe it. So then anytime I get that feeling, I know that in that inventory process, I need to write down old ideas on parenting, on... bosses, on politicians, on, whatever it is, just write a list of old ideas.
Yeah.
And I mean, they will come out, 15 of them.
Yeah.
And then I've got some meat on the bone, and I've got something that I can take to God. Because I can't, I had a big black hole of take to God. I didn't know what the hell I was ever taking to God. It was just fix it. It just hurts. Just fix it. You know, that was always my prayer. I don't like the way I feel. Do something. I'll do whatever. I don't know whatever is, but you know what I mean? I mean, it was just so lost and lonely feeling for so long until I started getting these things. And that's why when I heard that fear inventory you wrote, the why I have it opened that huge door for me to begin to start to see why I have it. Because I think I have it because I'm scared. See how shallow you can keep everything just... Or at least me, I'm sure y'all are much deeper than I am. Yeah, but I mean, I can keep it so shallow that I'm just not going any deeper with it. And with, of course, my sponsor's help, I get great depth. But that's why I liked it. Well, do you guys have any clarification?
Well, a couple of things. I really like what you just said, because I was thinking that earlier. When I've written some fear inventories, and they don't get that deep. And so I have two kind of questions. And one is, I pray before I do inventory. Not sincere enough, I don't know, but like how do you get your ego out of the way enough to get set? I am not that honest, even with myself. How do you get to that?
Like the dust of the bean, please.
No, it's pain. I mean, pain, desperate, I mean, absolutely understanding. I've been through the futility. And by the way, don't judge yourself by if you're starting out with this inventory, because I'm writing that inventory and I'm years sober, and I've been doing that for a while. I mean, I start out, I'm afraid of spiders and snakes and, the little girl down the street or something, That's where it is. And after writing this, what happens is I don't write much resentment inventory anymore. Resentment is just fear and drag, And if I'm resenting you, that's just a more socially, it's something socially acceptable way to express fear to me. I mean, that's my delusion. Anger's the drug, the numbing agent I put on top of my fear.
You have kind of a suggestion on a format to use when you're writing fear inventory. I heard you mention some things over and over in the one you read.
Well, it's just pretty much answering questions out of the book.
I which are what is the fear, why do I have it?
Yeah.
What,
perhaps, yeah, self-reliance, and perhaps God has a better.
And then actually write about that.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me ask you this.
I didn't fully finish answering.
Well, if it's along the same lines.
I mean, it's like a, you know, anything you do repetitively, you're going to become better at. You know, it's the same. See, what we've got here is a spiritual fitness program. We're going to the spiritual gym, folks. We don't go in and run a mile one time, lift the weights one time, and then leave the gym, and then come back next year. You know, you see, if you belong to a gym, you see that, you know, every just before swimsuit season and right after New Year's, everybody shows up. You can't get near any of the machines for a couple of weeks, and then they all go away, you know. And it's back to the people who are there on a consistent basis, lifting the weights every. And that's also been one of the spiritual awakenings here in this whole idea. See, what these things are, what I call my problems, are really God's opportunities. They're the weight I lift in the spiritual gym. My inability to get along with you, the fear I have, what's not going well, that's my opportunity to lift. I was up by Estes Park in the mountains out and standing in the stream with Don one time, and we were fishing for trout, and we were having a great day, and we were catching them and throwing them back and catching them and throwing them back. I says, how come, Don? I mean, I've done this sincerely under your direction for years and years and years, and I've still got every one of these damn defects as near as I can tell. What's up with that? And he says, oh, Mike, he says, it's a great deal like what you and I are doing here this afternoon. He says, what? He says, this isn't about the fish. He says, you and I are catching them and throwing them back. You know, it's about you and I having a place to spend time together and quality and share. So what my so-called problems and defects and everything else, those are the places where God and I get to meet and become intimate with each other. And it's like any relationship, as you grow in trust with somebody, the sharing becomes deeper, you know. Even with people we trust, you know, I share with Charlie and Katie at a different level than I did when I first met them. Now they're the same people, but we've done business with each other. We know we can trust each other. We've got a relationship that's established. So that does that help along that line? Yeah.
And I just to add on that, I love the fact that you brought up Charlie Pulsino, because I think that I have to sit down with the little worksheet that Katie gave us with my big book and my notebook and in front of my little mantle and like it's got to be this great deal, and it really doesn't happen.
No.
So when you sit on that right one of those amateurs, say you're not going to post it.
Just one second here.
Correct.
Since you mentioned that, here's a great exercise that Clint Hodges had me start to do. Post-it note. Well, I didn't want her to lose.
She's already asked three questions.
And then they come.
You have me in your office all afternoon.
Share, Charlie.
But no, here's one that was transformative. I'm not. Clint just asked me, Mike, grab a post-it note every morning and write down the four or five things you're not going to be willing to do today in order to have a better relationship with God. And I said, well, Clint, what about all the stuff I'm willing to do? And he said, well, now that won't be causing you any trouble, will it? So, I mean, you know, here's how that looked here. This is an old one here. I believe I can predict the future. I know when I go in the office, she's going to say that, he's going to say this, I'm going to do this, and they're going to do this, and this is how that's all going to go, God damn it. So I'm going to get in there, and I'm going to be locked and loaded and ready to go for them. I don't even have to listen to what you're going to say, by God. I'm ready for you.
Yeah.
Yeah. along the same vein. I've convinced myself that I can read minds. You know, she doesn't like me. You know, and you know he thinks you know I'm unwilling to just be average. I'll be the best you've ever seen or the worst you've ever seen. You know, I mean, I'll take either stance. But you know. Yeah, Mike, I think I remember him. He came to Austin sometime here. Mike F or something like that, you know. It just, And then I insist on, at that time, I remember what was going on. I lived this life full of distraction. And so I'm not drinking anymore, but I'm grabbing my credit card to go out and spend a little money I don't have. I drive around our beltway. Speed limit says it's 55. I drive 80. You know, and I'm as a result, I'm always watching for the cop. You know, is anybody on that on ramp, off ramp? You know, and so what I do, I travel miles and miles, and I don't know where I've been. I lose my own life. The precious thing, the thing that I can't get back and cannot be bought at any price, I just give away in terms of distraction. You know, and it can be, hey, that's what do you think that affair was all about? That was about distraction, excitement, that'll do it. Matter of fact, there was one connected to that. I left my office, the old office, to go shopping. It was at that time, it was right across from one of our little upscale malls, kind of like your domain here or whatever. And I'm going across the street, and the light starts to change, and I floor it and go through, and it was probably a little pink by the time I got through it. And this jerk in a green minivan just lays on the horn and honks at me. And I waved at him. And I go in and I'm looking for a parking place. And I finally look up in my rearview mirror. And I'll be damned if there's not a green minivan right on my bumper. And I go around and I park. And I pull in and I see the green minivan pulled in the next available spot. And I'm an old street fighter, so I know you don't ever let them catch you sitting down in your car. So I'm out of my car and around the back, and I'm ready for this. This, by the way, is your spiritual giant here and there. And this guy comes out of the green minivan, and I am loaded for bear. I mean, you know, I work out. I'm ready to go. I'm a combat veteran. All this. He looks at me. He says, "Mister, would you mind stepping over here and telling my little girl why you're getting that parking place a few minutes earlier than you would have otherwise was worth risking her life?" You see, it's not about the right answer, it's about the right question. We all are busy looking for answers, but if we get the right question, is this worth making my wife unhappy? Is this worth risking a child's life? Is this worth all whatever it may be? Is like, and most of us are really at heart decent people, and if you can get us and ask us the right question, we'll come up with the right answer. And see, that's what the ego's job is. It doesn't want that question asked. It'll say, "Well, you're a really good driver, so it won't matter for you to speed through the intersection, you know." Besides, they've got airbags in those minivans now, and you know, it's just all this rationalization. So anyway, I've gone on. Charlie, you've got a question coming.
I don't remember. No, I'm just going to say this. In your normal practice, when you knock out a post-it note like that, when you get a big revelation, a little revelation, then what do you do with it?
Oh, okay. Good thing. Went off on a tangent there. What Clint's instruction with this person though is I didn't need to step do anything about it. It was daily practice. Just put it in my shirt pocket and go on about my day. And as I lived by day and encountered difficulty, I was to take the post-it note out and look at what I'd written. It's there in my own handwriting. And that the problem, almost inevitably, the problem, whatever I was having, was as a result of a decision that I wasn't going to let God into this area of my life today. And so as he put it, you can go scrape the shit happens bumper sticker off the car. Shit isn't happening to you, Mike. You're making decisions based on self. And you invite that into your life. But it's not an accident. I see it. If for me, what it really did is it gave me a clear cause and effect relationship between what areas I was trying to allow God, giving God consent to operate in my life, and which ones I thought I can handle very nicely myself, or I wasn't, you know, God's answer wasn't going to be anything attractive or interesting to me. And, you know, just bit by bit by bit. See, it was what it created for me, Charlie, was awareness. You know, it wasn't all of a sudden one day the post-it note burst into flame and, you know, or anything. It was, oh, any place I decide to keep God out of my life, I can expect trouble. You know, or at least a lack of comfort. So,
what do you do when you wake up in the morning and you can't see anything from that note? Is there something you write instead?
Well, I only did that for about a year and a half, and you know I periodically done it since. So I mean, you know, I have a more meditative practice as I start my day than I did at that time. But,
yeah. I can imagine being waking up today and thinking, I'm good. Have you had those days where you just couldn't see?
There you got it. Put it right down there. I'm sufficient to on to everything else. I mean, I'm pretty well going to be able to handle the day. Thank you very much. You've got the day off, God.
I should have a pocket full of them. Yeah. Anybody
have any other questions?
I got one, Dave.
Okay.
Mike, I've been kind of stuck on the... on old ideas that, you know, topic that Katie's talking about specifically. Because how do you know, or how do you get to the point, or is it just awareness where you feel like those old ideas need to be set aside? Like, how do you know, when is it a new idea? When is it an old idea? Katie was talking about, you know, bad equaling old, and I think that's, at least for me, I've got to have some type of negative feedback or consequence in order to wake me up and see, oh, that's an old idea that I'm operating out of. So how do you get to that? And I mean, just to give you an example, there's old ideas between me and Mark in terms of parenting. You know, I believe my way is right. She believes her way is right. You know, we have the same kind of old ideas, I think, lots of times about money, you know. How do you know whether you're closed off or operating
on old ideas
or not?
I have a great deal of certainty about my position, so I spend my time explaining to you why your ideas are not correct. Okay. You know, I get to look at it, you know. My God, what? Just let's sit for an academic. What if your ideas are right? Oh, God damn, that means I'm wrong. And what's the fear behind if I'm wrong? Oh, if I'm wrong, you'll cast me out. You won't love me because I believe you love me because I'm right. I believe you, you know, all this kind of stuff. So I'm driven back, being driven into a position where I'm opposing the woman I love and want to cooperate in helping children I love. And, you know, that's about, you want to talk about an evil and corroding thread? That's a pretty good shot at it right there. And, you know, and my head's telling me this is rational and I'm being responsible. And, in fact, I'm even being courageous to stand up to her and her bad ideas. And, you know, and vice versa. I mean, it goes both ways. I mean, it can go, you know, gosh, I'm the woman, I'm supposed to be the nurturer, I'm supposed to know innately know all of this and everything else, and so I can't be wrong in this area, and, you know, we've, how do we get together? So I got to, scared people do not act well. So first of all, we got to get the level of fear down and make it safe. Safe to talk to each other. I mean, that's one of the big things that Don taught and Linda and I practiced together was practicing the traditions in our relationship. And one of the most important one of those things was the idea of group conscience. And that is not us taking a vote. That is us reasoning and talking and listening to each other prayerfully without fear is the extent possible. So I can even if I don't agree with her, I can understand where she's coming from. Understanding that, you know, voting's about power and that stops the group conscience. The great thing in relationship before I do anything is ask myself, is what I'm about to do or say going to take away from or add to the unity in this room? And is what I'm going to say likely to divide us or bring us closer together? That's a good one for me on a filter for restraint of pen and tongue, all this kind of stuff. So, I mean, all of this operates here. They're all spiritual principles, and they're all interconnected, and they're not any of them that are here as burdens for us. I went way far afield in there, but, you know, that area of group conscience, one of the best exercises Linda and I ever did together was coming up with a primary purpose with our relationship, and we changed it a couple times, you know. And who knew that I was busy loving her. I loved her like a rainbow. I'm busy loving her in ways that don't even register on her. That's not, you know, that was, I might as well have been talking to her in Swahili, you know. I don't care if you do that. I don't care if you buy that. I don't care, you know. Or pointing at you, she says, you know, taking me to the Colts game is not my idea of a date, you know. all that kind of stuff. So, we can climb out, find our fear, and have a safe way to communicate with each other. Because at the bottom line, I do love this woman, and I do want to please her. And, you know, and I don't do a very good job when I'm afraid and when I'm listening through fear, I don't hear what she's saying. You know, we don't. That doesn't mean we have to agree on everything. You know, in fact, you know, it'd be boring if we did. But we come to a place where those differences can complement each other, not divide us. That helpful, though?
Sometimes. We're trying to get on one CD. Honey, it says 109.
That's still another 5 minutes. Yeah. So, Erica has any. Well, and I can
see. Does anybody else have?
I can see this. And I know. Yeah. And I don't know if this is the appropriate forum, but I'm going to go for it anyway. There are things in my life that I... Like you said, I don't think God is going to help me with. When you were reading that inventory and when you spoke on Saturday night, it just spoke to me because I realized that a lot of the problems I'm still having in my life and the fear that all the self-centered fear that I'm living in the middle of that is making me crazy and miserable is because I don't believe that God will help me. And I don't believe that God cares. I really don't. I still believe I can manage my life. I don't think God's going to help me. I'm going to have this. And so I really like when you talk about the second part of that fear inventory, which is, you know, what would God have to look like for my fears to manifest and do what I believe God is? Where do you go from, what's the next step after that? Is it just that awareness and basically the repetitiveness of going, okay, no, my God does not do this. My God does not look like this. God loves me.
How many of us had one bad night drinking and got sober? You know. Okay. Well, see, what happens is we tend to be people who take some convincing. You know, even in the face of pain. So, you know, and I was no different, and the people that taught me didn't wake up one day wonderful, you know, time after time after time after painful experience. The thing is that the sad thing is to waste the pain. So you've got the pain and the miserable experience, but I learned nothing. The sad tragedy was that I had so much pain and created so much pain that I learned absolutely nothing from. I thought the answer was to, quote, try harder next time, get a redhead instead of the brunette, and, or, you know, whatever, you know, that it's this, that kind of stuff. I was dead to my own experience. Matter of fact, there's a meditation I did, and I mean, I'm part of it says I'm like Gulliver, bound and tethered by countless old ideas, you know, and I failed to learn from my own experience. You know, prayer is wake me up to my own experience so I see what's happening to me. You mentioned one of the things that was important for me to ask myself was just, what am I really saying when I say I want God's help? And when I say, okay, I want God to help me, it's kind of like if I told you, I'm going to be moving this weekend, and I'd like Charlie to come help me. Now, whether Charlie comes and helps or not, I'm moving, by the way. But it'd be nice if Charlie helped. And I really, so what I'm asking Charlie, will you come help do my will for me? And isn't that what I'm usually asking God for? God, here's what I want. Either to start or to stop or to go on, everything else, and I'd sure appreciate it if you'd show up and help me do my will. And I'm not seeking God's will because I'm sure you're a gal of good intentions. You've got good intentions and everything else, and you've got a plan, and you believe God should help you execute the plan.
Yeah.
Well, pay attention, more to follow. No, I mean that's intuitively where we all start, you know. And unfortunately, you're ahead of a lot of people because a lot of people never even get as far down the question road. You know, you can go out and get co-signed. Look, I just want this happy marriage and this nice house and this and that and the, you know, and to, you know, serve my clients with integrity and all this kind of stuff. None of that sounds bad. I can get it co-signed any time. But the problem is I'm not paying any attention or spending any time seeking God's will. One of the images I love from Tony DeMello is he says, you know, we're like people that are on a tour bus going through the Grand Canyon or some beautiful piece of countryside, and we've got all the curtains pulled over the windows, but we're fighting each other for the best seat in the bus, you know. It never occurs to me to open the damn window, you know. That's what it is. I don't need to fight for a better seat in the bus. I don't need to push you to the back of the line. I need to wake up, open the window, smell the coffee, what's there, you know. And, you know, and that's what the real lesson seems to be.